It's a masterpiece, I say. They will cheer every word, every letter.
I wish I felt that way.
I believe I can put it better.
Our next guest on Downtown is a historian at Yale University. She hosts the weekly History Matters webcast. She's co-host of the podcast Now and Then with Heather Cox Richardson, the author of a number of books, including The Field of Blood, Violence in Congress, and The Road to the Civil War. Well, she's an unabashed fan of the musical 1776. We're happy to be joined by our friend, Dr. Joanne Freeman. Let's begin with a topic that's in the news and also an anniversary Monday, the anniversary of the first Lincoln-Douglas debate. But historically speaking, and that was a senatorial debate, I believe, in 1858. But presidential debates, am I right that they're a relatively new phenomenon?
Well, they are. They're a sort of mid to late 20th century phenomenon. And, you know, the age of the Lincoln-Douglas debates was an age when people had more than a 3-minute attention span. So, you know, you could make these long speeches and people would stand in an audience if it were out in public and listened to it, and there were actual issues being discussed. You know, that was like the mid-19th century was like the great age of oratory. So those debates were actually debates, whereas, you know, particularly once you have television come along, our debates, we could argue, you and I could talk about to what degree people are actually debating anything, and it's really more about tossing out talking points and looking good and sounding good and seeming on top of your game somehow than anything else. And I suppose, you know, a president is supposed to look like and act like a leader, I suppose, in some ways. But this is definitely, you know, what we see now in debates on TV probably could be improved in a lot of ways.
So without debates, well, without mass media as we know it today, largely newspapers were it in the early days of the Republic. How did people position themselves to the average American as being worthy of their vote and fitting the mold of what we thought we might want in a president?
Well, once you had real organized political parties, and Andrew Jackson does that when he comes along in the first half of the 19th century, then often it's just a matter of party. And so you would have these conventions, and the conventions would pick a candidate, and then you would go with your party's candidate. But the end result of that is that sometimes you end up with a convention not being able to pick a candidate, and they pick someone who is not offensive to anybody, but who no one really knows. Actually, Franklin Pierce is a great example of this. Mm. When he ultimately gets picked to be the candidate for the Democrats. And I found when I was researching my most recent book in the newspaper, there are people who didn't know his first name. And he had all kinds of names that I found in the newspapers. Or he had a number of shifting middle names. Franklin A. Pierce. No, it's Franklin S. Pierce. Or actually even earlier than that, regarding, I believe it's like, maybe the election of 1796 or 1800, there's a choice made about who a candidate should be. I think in this case it was a Federalist, so that's the Hamiltonian side of things. And someone says, yes, I'm going for our candidate, the Federalist candidate, John Adams and one of the Pinckneys.
Wow. Well, Franklin Pierce, of course, there's a bit of a main connection there, is a graduate of Bates College.
I think he might have gone to Bowdoin.
Bowdoin. Oh, you're right. You're right. Yes. Yes. That's right. I knew it was a Maine school.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, and wasn't, if I remember the Pierce story, was it on the way to Washington to take office when his son was killed and run over by a train?
Oh, it's horrible. It's a horrible story. Yeah. He wasn't on his way to Washington, but he was traveling just before he was going to take office. And there was a train accident that killed his son in a horrible kind of a way. So he takes office with this, you know, dark cloud over his presidency, and his wife partially blames him and the presidency for the loss of his son. So that was actually a horrible thing.
Yikes. We're talking with Dr. Joanne Freeman here on Downtown. I know in your History Matters conversation today, you talked about what happened recently in Kansas with the police going through the offices of a newspaper out there and even into the home of the publisher of the newspaper. This is, for anybody who values the Constitution and the First Amendment, this is pretty frightening stuff.
It is very frightening stuff, and I'll only flesh out what you just said. I do a live webcast every Friday morning at 10 o'clock Eastern Time called History Matters, and so does coffee. And indeed, today I did talk about what went on in Kansas with the Marion County Record being invaded, basically, searched in a surprise search by the police and their computers and things seized and taken away. It's shocking because, you know, it does something that I think we're watching happen in a lot of different ways right now. And I'll throw in here book banning laws that don't really define what books are banned, or things that can't be taught but don't really define things that can't be taught. In one way or another, these are all meant to be intimidation or threats. They're meant to make people think twice before standing up against whoever's inflicting these things. So, you know, the people who were raiding and the newspaper office and seizing things, supposedly that newspaper is a feisty newspaper that is very opinionated. So one could certainly see that one of the messages sent by that was, yeah, okay, we'll teach you to do something we don't like. Here you go. Now, what's interesting about that is there's been a big response, right, of the very sort that you said, which is people saying, whoa, the police, like, jumping into a newspaper's office and seizing things? Like, really? That's hardly free speech. That's hardly a free press. I was speaking this morning about the sacking of Lawrence, Kansas, in the 1850s, when newspapers were destroyed and Lawrence, Kansas was savaged in the debate over whether Kansas would be a free state or a slave state. And that caused the same response, in which people said, whoa, wait a minute, what just happened there? So I suppose maybe it's a little reassuring that you actually can still cross lines and people will actually say something.
Yeah, well, it's good to see that because, as you mentioned, it's when it comes to the banning of books, it goes beyond buying books, it goes beyond libraries, it has extended into the world of education, college education, of course, but public schools around the country. And it's been interesting as an educator here to watch the mode of attack that the right has used, which is, I think, to realize that school boards might be the easiest way to gain ground because those are often not terribly hotly contested seats. You don't need a lot of votes to become a member of a school board around the country.
Right. And so on the one hand, that's easy to do. And then add to that the fact that a school board says, we don't want you teaching, let's say, critical race theory, but doesn't define what it is. So now every teacher is going to think, if I'm teaching about race, does this count as critical race theory? Because according to the government, I could get punished. Maybe I'm going to lose my job if I teach that sort of thing. So yeah, it's people getting into the school board or people threatening or you know, taking advantage of school board meetings or people, for example, threatening people who are working at polling places, who are poll workers. All of these things, in one way or another, they're meant to either frighten people enough to keep them away from getting in the way, or intimidate people into silencing themselves and stepping back. And, you know, I think it's easy to downplay what a threat, how powerful that can be. But my last book, The Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to Civil War, talks about Southern members of Congress using threats of violence, real violence, but also threats of violence, to keep people who oppose slavery down, to keep them quiet, to prevent them from standing up, to prevent them from saying anything anti-slavery in Congress. And that kind of thing works. If you're afraid you're going to get beaten or challenged to a duel for standing up and saying something, you're at least going to think twice.
Man, we've seen schools in our area, one nearby, where I guess they viewed it as a compromise, but the school board said, Well, if any students want to read any of these controversial books that are in the library, they will need to get permission from their parents to check out those books.
Ugh. All right. Well, you know, one of the things that I always think about in what we're seeing right now is there's a certain group of people that decides that they're offended by something. Sometimes they don't even say why they're offended by it. They just declare a book horrible and out of bounds, and they might use words to pin to it, but it's not clear. Like, really, is this book sexual in any way? Unclear. But because they say they don't like it, that parent has a say. And the other parents, who would be perfectly fine with their child having access to all kinds of books, not sexual material, but just books that actually have very nothing wrong with them, they lose that access. So it's a small group of people making decisions for a big group of people.
I like to maybe not always talk with you about violence in our government, because I know that certainly was the topic of your last book. And I feel like, oh, we can't always ask Joanne about that, but it keeps coming up. And so now we've got certainly a unique situation in American history with the former president and his supporters making some pretty inflammatory comments. And already we've seen threats of violence against judges, members of the grand jury, and the possibility of really poisoning the jury pool for a trial in the case of the Georgia indictments. Has there been anything like that with an elected official, obviously not a president, in past history?
Well, I mean, certainly in a general kind of a way, there were threats aplenty being tossed out by, like I said, sometimes members of Congress. But what we see now is kind of an organized plot with a former president egging it on, threatening officials in advance of what ultimately will be probably a trial of some kind. And it as you said right in the middle of your question, we haven't had a president do this before, and there you have the rub, because we don't have anything to compare it to, and we all have a sort of gut feeling that that's not right, that that's intimidating a jury, that that's finding a way to have an impact on a trial in a way that is not how the rule of law works. But then the bigger question is, what do we do about that? And that's, you know, again and again and again, we come up against these violations, sometimes of laws, sometimes just of norms. And then we have to, particularly in the case of a norm violated, like the police force entering a newspaper office, or like a former president threatening judges before a trial, big question. What do you do? How do you know what to do? And what's really interesting about that to me, other than the fact that we're all sort of sitting here in the midst of all this anxiety, but as a historian, what's interesting to me about that is that I study early America, and that's a period in which everything was being done for the first time. And I used to try and create for myself what might have felt like to be in government in some way in the 1790s, and every time something happens, some decision has to be made, everyone has to, they would talk about, what do? Do we stand? Do we sit? Should we be in one room? Should we be in two rooms? How, you know, what are the rules? And they had huge anxiety about this, because they assumed if they made the wrong decision, the entire government might fall. And that, like, colors the whole beginning of American history. But now, in a way, we have echoes of that, where sometimes we don't know what is going to happen or what should happen. And I guess I would say I feel a kind of empathy for the people I write about in a different kind of a way now.
So I'd like you to maybe project 30, 40 years into the future for historians of, let's say the 2050s. When the history is written of this time in American politics, American life, obviously it doesn't begin with the election of Donald Trump. When did the pendulum begin to swing in this direction?
Well, right. And that's a really important point, because it's not as though Donald Trump came along and then suddenly all of this happened. And you can go back a number of decades to see this, you know, among others, Newt Gingrich and others sort of helping this style of politics be born. But, you know, I was thinking about that today, this morning, and if I were a historian in the future, what are some of the things that I would grab at? And one of the things that came to me is just you would see, as a historian, I'd be reading newspapers, and you're lucky enough now to have things on social media and on TV and all kinds of ways in which you can get evidence. But by then, I would know what happened. And so there I would be as a historian thinking to myself, they really think that? Or did they, were they, what kind of a lie was that? You know, I'm sure future historians will be wrestling with the fact that some of the decisions being made now either make no sense or are so obviously meant for no good. And they'll know, right? They'll be looking back in hindsight in ways that we can't.
We're talking with Dr. Joanne Freeman here on Downtown, a co-host of the wonderful podcast Now and Then with our friend Heather Cox Richardson. And on this week's show, a really fascinating discussion about women's sports, the recent controversy involving the Women's World Cup soccer team, reactions to that, and the whole idea that people are actually paying attention to women's sports in a way that we couldn't have envisioned half century ago.
Right. And so that's the upside, is that people are interested in women's sports, they're paying attention to women's sports. But of course, the other, or maybe not the other half, maybe we'll divide it in thirds. I'm not good at math. But another component of it is, in some cases, people are paying attention to women on sports teams to critique them in some way. You know, maybe they're dressing wrong, or maybe they're too aggressive, or maybe, you know, there are all kinds of ways in which women essentially get policed for what they do, just normal things that they would do when on a team, like pulling off your jersey and revealing your sports bra in victory at a time when women were just wearing sports bras to the gym. So it was nothing bad, but suddenly that becomes a debate. Ooh, is that proper?
I have to ask you about that, too, because I didn't remember this when you brought it up in the podcast, that they actually must have been in the mid-70s, began selling sports bras that were marketed as Title IX bras.
Oh, there was a whole company called Title IX.
Wow.
I believe it still exists. And yeah, they sell a lot of things, but they sell sports bras for sure.
Title IX bras. That is amazing. But, you know, what I find fascinating, too, is in the midst of this discussion of women's sports, you get a lot of people of a certain political persuasion who have created what I think is a non-issue, the idea that transgender athletes are taking opportunities away from women. What's ironic to me is that the people making this case most likely were or would have been opposed to Title IX.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, no, that's probably true. Well, and it just, you just suggested, some of this is so clearly to score some kind of point rather than to be logical. You know, it's meant to create a side in a political debate, but also a kind of cultural and social debate. So I read this morning, and you can tell me if this makes sense, because I don't know a lot about chess, but I read that now there's concern about transgender, I'm going to get it wrong, women playing on the wrong team or men playing on the wrong team. They're worried about transgender people on, not even teams, playing chess with the wrong gender.
Wow.
And my question is, why does gender matter in chess? Maybe I'm missing something obvious here, but that feels to me so like a sort of thing you create when you really want something to exist.
Oh, I think that's absolutely what it is, that they're fighting a battle that doesn't really exist out there. I mean, I do think we're at a time in our society where it might be wise to question some of the things that we do on a gender-specific basis. I know, for instance, in the world of theater and acting, they've talked about maybe we should get away from awards for actor or actress and just give out one award for the best performance regardless of gender.
Well, it's always good to evaluate. You know, I mean, I'm a political historian. I'm one for debate and compromise. And, you know, I think particularly at times of when change seems particularly striking and we're in one of those moments, sure, it makes sense to evaluate things, to come together with people who disagree and make some kind of decision. That decision will be hated by some people for sure, and it'll be controversial, but change can be good. And here's the thing. Here's the upside of living during a time of extreme change or extreme contingency, and that is we really don't know what's going to happen. So in some ways, anything can happen. And there are two sides to that. On the one hand, you could say, oh, boy, something really bad could happen because we just don't know, and this is a time of extreme change. But on the other side, you can say, oh, positive change is actually really possible if we're at a moment of change. And I think a lot of people miss the second half of that equation, that it's not all doom and gloom. There's certainly doom and gloom. But that at this kind of a moment, people can come together and push for positive change, and that they shouldn't surrender to what might seem like the fate and just happens to be the direction that things are pushing right now.
So can we find any guidance from history in where we go from here? There will be a time, I'm sure, I hope, when we don't talk about the former president every day, but there remains a percentage of Americans who believe at least some of what he has said over the last several years. I hope that number is less than we sometimes hear, and a lot of it is because of political expedience. But are there lessons from history, maybe in the post-Civil War period, of how the majority works around a minority of people who have an alternate reality?
Right. And, you know, that's, I've written a lot about the 1850s, which leads right into the Civil War, and many people, including me, in op-eds, have said, wow, this really echoes a lot with the 1850s, which does not mean I think we're going to have a Civil War. But certainly post-war, you had a moment when people were still, even before Reconstruction, you had a moment when people were still not sure if or how they would be able to come together. You had, you know, what one might call unreconstructed Southerners who were still adamantly right where they were before. It's not an easy process of bringing people together. But, you know, in some cases, for some people, and this happens earlier in history too, sometimes, particularly after something really savage or violent or nasty or just a long period of upset, people get tired of it. People can see beyond it. People want something better. They want something more. And, you know, I'm not saying we have to go through a civil war for people to realize, oh, darn, I think I'm over this now. But I do think more and more and more people are becoming and will be becoming tired of all of the division and all of the extremism and all of the ways in which people are threatening other people. I'm a historian, so I look back, not forward. But it's a really good question as to down the pike, maybe not that far down the pike, what will Americans do? How will they come together? And particularly young people, how will people come together and produce positive change?
That's the question right there. All right, I have to ask about some really important things. How is Newbie the History Bird?
Newbie the History Bird. Oh, I love that you asked that question. Newbie the History Bird is my parakeet, who was found in Central Park during the pandemic. So he's my pandemic bird, and I think he's the world's only history bird who can actually say, I'm a history bird, so he's talented. He is good. He actually partakes sometimes in my podcast and webcast by banging his bell very loudly or squawking. So he's a ham. He has things to say about history, too.
Oh, I've heard him weighing in, yes, and it's clear when he wants to know that he has something to say, and I appreciate that.
I will pass this along to him.
And I was wondering about this. Is there, because I know you love Broadway shows, you love musicals, is there a, maybe it's 1776, which we've talked about before, is there a cast recording that you turn to in moments when you need that escape from the present day?
Oh, wow, that's a tough one. I would say now there's not a single one that I turn to. I just love cast recordings, truly. But when I was a kid, it was Man of La Mancha that I always turned to. And I think it was partly because it was this person who was sort of reaching out for, you know, the unreachable star, you know, reaching for good things. And I wanted to know that story. Although, to tell you the truth, when I asked my father when he was playing the cast recording and I heard it for the first time, I said, what is this about? And he said, it's a man who's trying to right all the wrongs. And I thought my father meant write them down. And I thought, it's going to take a really long time.
It was, I take it, as a great, more than just coincidence the other day when we were locking in a time for our conversation today. We were actually re-airing at that moment our conversation from a few years ago with William Daniels, who played John Adams in 1776.
Wow. Well, he's a great favorite. And 1776 is one of the things that led to my becoming a historian. And actually, you know, it's a good thing to think about because that was the bicentennial. And I was inspired by the bicentennial, and I was reading, I was a kid, but I was reading biographies of people from the founding period, and my brothers and I loved that cast recording so much, and then ultimately the movie, that we essentially memorized the entire thing, and my parents had to play it on their 8-track tape player in the car anytime we went on a trip. So I always feel special fondness for William Daniels, since, and in a way, you know, he was part of the period that brought me, took me a long time to figure out I was supposed to be a college professor in history, a historian, but he helped start the path.
I graduated in the bicentennial year, and my memory of that is that, well, on the downside, we had to wear red, white, and blue graduation gowns to celebrate.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, that was that was a little rough, but you know, then again, I just survived wearing a powder blue tux to the senior prom, so maybe the gown wasn't so embarrassing after all. But I also, I made some pretty good money that year. Maybe it it might have led to this work in radio, because I remember winning a speech contest that year, and the topic was what the bicentennial means to me.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. So maybe it did help. And you know, we have the sesquicentennial coming up, the 250th. anniversary, which, you know, is in the mix. So I think it'll be really interesting to see how that develops, how it plays out, and what impact that might have on people.
Yeah, I'm hoping we still have a democracy by that big anniversary. That would be great.
Yeah, I'm hopeful, but the fact that we even have to say that makes me want to bang my head against the wall.
It is always a delight to talk with you, Joanne. Thank you so much for making time for us this afternoon. Hope you have a great semester at school, and please do give our best to Newbie.
Oh, I will. Thank you so much for having me. I love being on your show.